to 80% of their $9 billion worth of ads for the year. For several weeks in May 2016, 39 digital companies sponsored presentations at which they made their pitch to about 10,000 advertisers and agency representatives. The new front is organized by Randall Rothenberg's Interactive Advertising Bureau, and MediaLink kicked off the new front at a May 2nd breakfast at the New York Times Center on West 41st Street, presided over by Michael Kassin. MediaLink served as host and sent the invites, though the breakfast was paid for by two MediaLink clients, Vox Media and Cargo, a mobile marketing firm. The large hall was crowded with agency representatives and with many of Kassin's digital clients. By his count, Kassin says he represents 80% of the digital companies seeking to sell ads at the new front. Surveying the crowded room, Harry Kargman, the founder of Cargo, said he saw the breakfast as an opportunity. MediaLink allowed Cargo to be in front of people we may not have had the ability to get in front of, he says. We want CMOs to say, what are we doing with Cargo? That's what he hoped happened when he spoke at this breakfast. And after this breakfast, he said, Michael can pick up the phone and say, you've got to know this guy Harry Kargman. This schmooze-fest was gently interrupted by two panel discussions, the first moderated by Kassin, at which Jim Bankoff, CEO of Vox, without ever mentioning CBS or the networks, sought to distinguish premium digital video ads, primarily native ads offered on Vox, from the interruptive ads on television. Bankoff defined a premium ad as having three qualities. It's creative, it loads quickly, and it engages me rather than interrupts me. Bankoff and Kargman nodded their agreement on the second panel when Kassin concluded by declaring an end to the network's upfront monopoly. I am a strong believer in this becoming a video front. It's all one. And at the end of the day, we subscribe to all the platforms and love all of the children equally. If you adopt that view, it's all the same. The silos are broken down. The new front brought bombast as well as competition. At YouTube's well-attended new front presentation at the Javits Center, CEO Susan Wojcicki declared fallaciously that YouTube reached more 18 to 49-year-old mobile viewers during prime time than the top 10 shows combined. But as noted earlier, reach does not equal viewing. Nielsen reports that the average audience per minute on television accounts for 95% of video watching, with smartphone video accounting for only 1% and PCs 4%. Dave Morgan, the CEO of Simulmedia, a marketing technology company that designs targeted TV ad campaigns, says TV's ability to attract eyeballs far exceeds that of internet darlings like YouTube. Judge Judy today in 30 minutes, he says, will deliver more seconds of advertising consumed by more people than all of YouTube will in all of America all day. One show. Actually, more than YouTube delivers in an entire month, an RBC Capital Markets 2014 analysis reported. With 260 episodes per year, each containing 8 minutes of advertising for Judge Judy's 9 million daily viewers, an estimated 1.6 billion minutes of ads were offered viewers, or twice as many as the 830 million minutes of ads per month on YouTube. Some disruptions occur more slowly, at least in the short run, even with traditional TV's vulnerabilities. CBS and the networks have strengths other legacy and digital media can only envy. Networks may one day lose some leverage if programmatic advertising becomes dominant, but in 2015, Martin Sorrell said WPP sold only about 3% of its ads programmatically. Networks like CBS still command the attention of a vast audience. 10 of the top 10 rated shows on network TV in February 2016 were on CBS, the first time ever that a single network captured all 10. By 2016, CBS owned just over 80% of the programs it aired in prime time, allowing the network to sell those shows to TV outlets in the United States and abroad. And by 2016, Thus, Moonves's CBS was making more money than when he joined CBS 20 years before. "When I first came here," Moonves says, "the CBS television network was losing money. Other parts of CBS, like the local stations it owns, were making money. Today, the network is the primary profit engine, one of several reasons CBS outperformed all media stocks over the previous 5 years." Entering the 2016 upfront marketplace, all the networks knew that the 2015 upfront fell below expectations, with lower volume of sales and CPMs, or cost per thousand viewer. In the months leading up to the 2016 upfront, and the ensuing negotiations between buyers, the agencies, and sellers, the networks, Moonves says, it's always a cat-and-mouse game. Someone always has the upper hand. Because a disappointing 2015 upfront was followed by ad prices jumping 15 to 20% over the rest of the year in what's called the scatter market, and because he believed the bright, shiny object, as he referred to digital video, had lost its luster, in late April he predicted that this upfront will be a little bit of a renaissance for networks. His head of sales, Joanne Ross, would set a higher CPM price. Several days earlier, Erwin Gottlieb of Group M, the largest buyer, relaxing in his office, wearing an open-necked pink dress shirt and tailored jeans, sat on a low couch and likened the upfront to a futures market. There was a futures market for Bordeaux in 2000 and 2003, but there wasn't in 2001, 2002, or 2004. You know why that was? The better vintages had scarcity. Good wine and reduced supply equals a strong futures market. Television continues to be a limited supply market. It will be a little more limited this year because I think people are looking very seriously at reducing commercial loads. Thus, he predicted, as did Moonves, a buoyant upfront for the networks, which led Gottlieb to conclude that the buyer who jumps in early and makes a large dollar commitment to a strong network like CBS is likely to get a price break. To illustrate, he had his assistant place 10 bottles of water on the coffee table. Let's say the total supply is 10 bottles and the cost per bottle is $100. Thus, the total market demand is $1,000. If I buy 8 bottles at a 2% advantage because I bought early, the cost is reduced to $784. Similarly, if he chooses to buy late for a weaker network, the bet he is making is that the faltering network will offer a steeper discount in order to finally sell its ad inventory. For the buyer, the question is always, how do we read the futures market? What the seller always tries to do is steer the buyer away from a pure economic analysis by stroking their emotions in an upfront presentation with the kind of showmanship the new front cannot match. CBS invited thousands of buyers and the press to Carnegie Hall on May 18th, where they were welcomed from the stage by Joanne Ross, who came out in a floor-length white fur coat, white top hat, and bedazzled cane. A video greeting from Hamilton creator Lin-Manuel Miranda was followed by late-night comic host James Corden performing as Hamilton in an 18th century costume, surrounded by an ensemble and rapping, "We just want your Hamiltons." Lisa DeMoraes of the Washington Post tweeted, "Another Hamilton segment at an upfront. This makes 3, or is it 4? But when Corden finished, she tweeted, "James Corden's Hamilton performance puts other networks' upfront Hamilton references to shame, including ESPN's Hamilton, ABC's Hamilton, and, sorry, Jimmy Fallon's Hamilton." Corden introduced Moonves, who took shots at various competitors before stepping aside to allow the introduction of CBS's fall primetime schedule, including the 20 new shows, all of them wholly or partially owned by the network. With Joanne Ross as orchestra leader, or Mama as she joyously called herself, an array of well-known actors, newscasters, and executives trotted onto the Carnegie Hall stage. When upfront sales ended later that summer, Moonves blared that 2016 was the strongest upfront we have seen in many years. He said CBS enjoyed double-digit price increases, Erwin Gottlieb concurred. CBS did extremely well. Joanne Ross is as good as there is in the business. She knows how to read the marketplace. What didn't change is that since network TV was the only way to reach a mass audience, the networks continued to get higher prices for shrinking live audiences, and thus less viewing of ads. How long will this CBS advantage last? Will the advantage erode as technology enables buyers to cobble together a digitally targeted mass audience? Those two questions will hover over Les Moonves's head in coming years. Michael Kassin, among others, believes Les Moonves will not like the answers to those questions. True, Kassin reflected, 2016 was one of the best upfronts. There was a flocking back to television as a safe place. Why? Because buyers in 2015 decided to spend less on the upfront, wagering that the scatter market would be less expensive, and they guessed wrong. This year, he believes buyers said, "I don't want to get burned again." Nevertheless, he echoed a view shared by Gottlieb. For Moonves and the networks, it was a short-term win, I think. 12. More frenemies. We recast our business as communications marketing. The reason we did that was we wanted access to the marketing budgets, and we wanted to signal you don't have to go to an ad agency to get marketing results. Richard Edelman. The advertising business is being invaded from all directions. A plethora of Michael Kassin's media clients, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, NBC, Condé Nast, Hearst, Vox, Refinery29, among others, are stealthily building out their own in-house advertising agencies. In 2015, Kassin believed that the primary disruption threat to agencies was to the media agencies that massaged the data, devised strategies, and purchased advertising time. He shared the view that Google and Facebook would one day go directly to agency clients and say, "Why do you need an agency in the middle?" By early 2016, Kassin's view had shifted. "I think the most likely to be disrupted now are the traditional creative agencies, and I'll tell you why. Every publisher from Condé Nast to Hearst to NBC to Disney now has creative agency units being built inside. So Condé Nast has 23 stories. Hearst is making all these investments in digital content creation. NBC has a content studio. Their mission is to sit down with Procter & Gamble and say, 'We can bring you ideas. We actually know how to create it.' They're not saying this, but the implication is, why do you need a traditional advertising agency?" Today, up to three-quarters of the up to $2 trillion or so that is spent worldwide on advertising and marketing is not funneled through the creative ad agencies featured in Mad Men. The rise of below-the-line marketing expenditures, including public relations, polling, design, branding, lobbying, and in-store sales promotions, was why Martin Sorrell and rival holding companies vied to stave off disruption by acquiring marketing firms. Platoons of disruptors keep coming over the ridge. Among them, none is more surprising than publishers posing as ad agencies. This ambition was on display on a visit to the New York Times in January 2016. The Times employed an advertising sales team of 325 people, and if you spied them at their desks, you saw that nearly half were coders and designers, and copywriters creating ads for clients rather than just selling ad space. Under Chief Revenue Officer Meredith Levien, they worked for the T-Brand Studio, whose purpose she described this way. "We are now in the business of making advertising. Our ad salesperson goes out with a content creator to meet clients. The ads they create are interchangeably described as native ads or branded content, and they involve crafting stories featuring a brand. These look little different from a news story in the digital edition, except they carry a modest-sized advertorial label at the top of the page, paid for and posted by. With mobile becoming the dominant digital platform, native ads were necessary, she says, because the small phone screen left no adjacent space on the page for ads. Thus, new ad forms were needed. The T-Brand studio is separate from the newsroom, says Time CEO Mark Thompson, insisting that the church-state barrier has not been breached. Much of the sales force is composed of former journalists, which he sees as a calling card. Clients come to us wanting to work with people comfortable with the idiom of storytelling. They don't have that with the agencies. And the agencies are locked into formats. We have a group of people who are used to inventing new formats. We offer a more open-ended approach. The Times aspired to serve as a near full-service agency. They bought a digital company, Hello Society, that offers audience analytics and strategic alliances with influencers from its arsenal of 1,500 social media stars. They train ex-journalists and hire videographers to craft native video ads for mobile phones. They sell consulting services. They recruit employees skilled in distributing content on social networks. They are, Thompson says, helping clients figure out how to use social media platforms. We're beginning to offer a broader portfolio of useful marketing services. The Times is not yet a meaningful disruptor. Its T-Brand studio produced revenues of just $35 million in 2015. But this represented a jump of 150% over the prior year. The incursions add up when you throw in the native ad revenues in 2016 of almost $600 million for Vice, $250 million for BuzzFeed, and about $60 million for the Wall Street Journal. Vice Media went a step further and formed a global ad agency, Virtue Worldwide, helping clients like Lululemon and Unilever brands like Dove's personal care products and Breyers Ice Cream shape marketing and ad campaigns to reach younger consumers. Refinery29 provides about 2,000 stories per month targeted mostly at women and aiming to help people discover and refine their personal style. Philip von Borres, a co-founder, says, "We think of ourselves as a creative toolset for brands, helping them reach the 140 million women who visited his site each month by the winter of 2016. Of his 350 employees, 110 of them were tasked with creating native ads. Brands need us because we have an audience and we have data." He would not disclose his ad revenues, but said they rose 70% in 2015. In England, David Pensell, the former marketing director of The Guardian newspaper, and now CEO of the umbrella Guardian Media Group, doesn't sound as if he embraces that newspaper's leftist attitude toward capitalism when he describes the teams of storytellers and graphic artists that he has forged into Guardian Labs, with a staff of 200 working directly with brands. Guardian Labs is evolving into how do we help brands sell their stories. That could be by creating films. It could be producing print products or blogs. There are a whole bunch of assets I think we can create on behalf of our clients that will not deceive our audience. In appearance, Pemcell could pass for a smooth ad executive, with his fashionable stubble, square red-framed glasses, and a black V-neck tossed over a white shirt. In reality, he makes clear that he is taking aim at Martin Sorrell and cumbersome agencies, who he believes will be threatened by media owners like The Guardian and Vice beginning to create advertising on behalf of our clients to get to the audience. The Guardian and Vice and The Times are hardly alone in creating internal agencies. Most traditional media companies, from Condé Nast to Hearst to NBC to Time Inc., have molded what they refer to as content studios to work directly with brands. The more immediate disruption threat to agencies comes from many former clients like consulting companies that are also invading the advertising and marketing business. "Several years ago, we thought Google was going to eat our lunch," Sorrell says. "Lately, it's become more of a Facebook threat." But the bigger menace, he says, may come from companies who have relationships with corporate CEOs, or who have special skills to go along with their deep pockets. People always said McKinsey would move into the marketing space, which they are increasingly doing. And Bain and the Boston Consulting Group. And then you're getting accounting firms that split their auditing and consulting functions. Accenture was our auditors. IBM buys 3 advertising firms in 1 week. Then there are the software companies, Salesforce.com, Oracle, so you've got layers. One reason Sorrell's WPP formed the marketing consulting firm Vermeer in 2014, as Publicis in early 2015 acquired the much larger global consulting firm of Sapient, was to better compete with consultants who had the ear of C-suite executives and were aggressively offering marketing services. The competitive threat from consulting companies was given a boost by John Mandel's vilification of the holding companies. Unlike in Silicon Valley, marketing disruptors don't hide in a garage nurturing a new idea with the zeal of a founder. The threat usually comes from established corporations with a pool of capital and eagerness to seize a fresh business opportunity. The largest digital ad agency in the country today is IBM, Michael Kassin says. Accenture now has a digital agency. Deloitte has a digital agency. Ernst & Young has a digital agency. Maurice Levy spent $3.7 billion to buy essentially a consulting firm, Sapient. He believes Levy was correct to do so because he wanted to confront the danger from companies like IBM. Levy had reason to quake. For at the end of 2015, the 3 largest global digital agencies by revenue, according to Advertising Age, were companies new to the marketing business. IBM, Accenture, and Deloitte. And the market cap or stock value of IBM, about $165 billion, was double the combined value of the 6 largest advertising and marketing holding companies. WPP, Publicis, Omnicom, IPG, Havas, and Dentsu. IBM is worth a detour, for it has entered the marketing business at warp speed. In May 2015, Advertising Age named IBM's Interactive Experience, IX, division the largest global digital agency. Later in 2015, IBM ingested live streaming and marketing software companies. Over 2 weeks in February 2016, it purchased 2 digital advertising agencies in Germany and 1 in the United States, and announced that it planned to open design studios in Prague, Warsaw, and Dubai. Worldwide, IBM had marketing offices in 30 locations and a staff of more than 10,000 performing creative and marketing design work for companies. Paul Pappas, the global leader of its Interactive Experience division, announced, "We're raising the bar for experience-led digital marketing and commerce." Coupled with its October 2015 acquisition of the online assets of the weather company, weather.com, IBM made it clear that it was in the data business. Joanna Pena Bickley works for Pappas and is the global chief creative officer for IBM iX. Her career started at ABC News, which she left to invent a video player to deliver streaming news videos and to design company websites. After the dot-com crash, she spent the next decade working for advertising agencies owned by WPP and Omnicom. Thinking that agencies were too focused on mass, like TV and full-page newspaper ads, and not focused enough on solving the business problems of companies, she started a marketing company that grew to 150 employees. IBM iX acquired her company, and together she said they set out to rethink the agency world. The hole in the market, they saw, was that data was not being used to zero in on what individuals wanted or needed and to solve large corporate problems. Agencies are in a race to the bottom. They are losing talent, and the reason is that they have commoditized their creativity. Their corporate bosses at the holding companies, she believes, dwell too much on finances, including selling more 30- and 60-second ads. The people that will win the race in the end will be the people who can fundamentally refine and make new products out of data. This data, for instance, tells IBM that large numbers of millennials don't want to own cars. They want to share them. So when representing an auto company, IBM iX brings a team to the auto company to tackle this big business problem. And employing the data its engineers, writers, and designers assemble, they craft individualized messages to reach these millennials. Although her creative department hired 1,500 designers and writers in 2015, and would hire another 1,500 in 2016, she said IBM would not supplant creative ad agencies. Your ad agencies will still absolutely play a role in the innovation that we create. There's really room at the table for everyone. Our focus isn't ever going to be in the ad creation or campaign creation. It will always focus on innovation. She is sugarcoating, because her use of data and strategizing might not leave much room at the table for Erwin Gottlieb's Group M. In the world of data gatherers, IBM sees weather as a beachhead. Weather reports trigger emotional and very human responses that yield important marketing clues. Weather offers IBM an opportunity to marry data and marketing. For example, people tend to get depressed when it rains, which boosts both soup sales and movie watching. High pollen counts cue Walgreens ads. Inclement weather might trigger a company to advertise its all-weather tires. Steamy weather invites Gatorade ads. We process billions of data points a day about the weather, says Jay Henderson, director of IBM's marketing cloud. The weather, IBM CEO Ginni Rometty declared in a keynote speech at the Consumer Electronics Show in January 2016, is the most pervasive impact source of data there is. It is why IBM acquired weather.com. Another reason IBM acquired weather.com and its digital agencies was to mate them with Watson, a supercomputer that uses artificial intelligence and software to answer verbal questions, as Apple's Siri, Amazon's Alexa, or Google's Home strives to. But Watson's ambition is to be much more than a personal digital assistant. Its goal is to be capable of cognitive reasoning, like a human. Unlike a human, it would be capable of processing enormous amounts of data to unearth a single correct answer, or to search for patterns to predict behavior. Watson searched weather.com and instantly awarded an IBM client, the Campbell Soup Company, with locations to invest their marketing dollars. Watson sweeps the internet for what millions of people write on social networks and blogs. Instead of using standard measurement tools, clicks, CPMs, demographics, geography, it identifies personality types and interests that advertisers can precisely target. Instantly, Watson can scoop up sports fans, personalizing marketing messages to individuals. IBM is betting that ads directed at individuals will result in highly relevant marketing that may please rather than annoy. It worked for Unilever when it partnered with IBM's weather company and created a new platform, Watson Ads, allowing consumers to tap into their mobile phone or computer and ask for a mayonnaise recipe using favored personal ingredients. The big thing, more than anything else, Jeremy Steinberg, the weather company's global sales chief, announced, is that Watson is going to help humanize the advertising experience. It allows consumers to have a one-on-one relationship with brands like never before. Of course, some part of what Steinberg and IBM hypothesize is blue sky. Artificial intelligence has been a holy grail since the birth of computers, and more than a half century later, we're not there yet. Progress may be slower than visionaries predict. Racing alongside IBM are consulting company giants. What was once known as Arthur Andersen, primarily an accounting firm, is now Accenture, the world's largest consulting company, which offers marketing as a new service. With 358,000 employees in 120 countries in 2015, including 80,000 employees in India, and three-quarters of the Fortune Global 500 companies as clients, Accenture is a behemoth. By 2015, digital marketing revenues totaled 41% of all marketing spending in the United States. According to an analysis of more than 1,000 agencies by Advertising Age's data center, Accenture Interactive's revenues ranked number one in the United States and the world, followed by IBM. Accenture Interactive offers digital marketing, shapes creative messages, provides strategy, data, analytics, and mobile services to clients. They have recruited almost 40,000 design and creative professionals to work in marketing. Companies like Accenture have an advantage in recruiting talent. The average employee at Accenture makes 3 times as much as the average person at WPP, observes Terry Kawaja, whose small investment banking firm, Luma Partners, focuses on the marketing and tech sector. Deloitte, with 225,000 global employees, has also aggressively expanded its marketing footprint. John Dunham, a former management consultant who today runs a branding consultancy in San Francisco, rates Deloitte as an especially formidable threat to agencies. Like Accenture and IBM and other consulting firms, they already have an edge because they have relationships with top management. They had already been vetted, so it was easy for them to move over into the marketing side. They understood who the customers were, understood the data. All they were doing was adding new services. Deloitte not only bought media companies, they bought a top-notch creative shop in San Francisco named Heat. All of a sudden, they had capabilities to go against full-service agency offerings. Deloitte, IBM, and Accenture confront intense marketing competition from other giants, including McKinsey, Bain, the Boston Consulting Group, PricewaterhouseCoopers, and Infosys. Tech companies also jockey to compete. Adobe, Oracle, and Salesforce.com race to offer cloud services that gather data on customers, target potential consumers, reach them on various company platforms, and generate information about what works to reach consumers and what doesn't. A galactic war is being waged between digital and tech companies, says Dan Rosenzweig, a former COO of Yahoo and now CEO of Chegg, an online textbook rental and tutoring company who serves on the board of Adobe. They vie to let you know not only what does the person do, but how do we get the person to come to your site? Once they're on your site, did they buy? How many steps did they go through? How can you make your site more efficient? And then testing which words and prices worked better. That's the modern-day ad agency. Ann Lunis, the CMO of Adobe, saw Adobe's cloud services providing valuable data on its 6 million $10 per month individual subscribers who use its Photoshop to edit and share photos or host websites. Adobe charges steeper fees to corporate customers like WPP and Publicis, who covet their data and have signed on as Adobe partners. Since they generate data and seek to know more about individual consumers, and WPP's Group M or Kantar does as well, aren't they bound to collide? We're not selling data, Lunis says. We're leveraging data. It's a little different. Rosenzweig is blunter. At the moment, it is not competition. But he concedes, 10 years from now, it could be. Oracle did directly compete with Sorrel and Erwin Gottlieb to acquire Datalogix, a firm that massages data and helps analyze purchasing patterns, linking them to online ad campaigns to gauge how well or poorly an advertising campaign performed. When the bidding competition for Datalogix climbed north of $1 billion, Sorrel and Gottlieb dropped out. Gottlieb conceded it was a company we lusted after, but admitted that WPP has a competitive disadvantage against companies with deeper pockets. The company they lusted after took time to attain altitude. Eric Rosa, the CEO of Datalogix, started out by sweeping up sales data from catalog companies. He says he assumed that what people purchased in the past was an indicator of what they would purchase in the future. He next went to grocery chains and their discount loyalty programs, collecting their data on what groceries their customers purchased. His big breakthrough came when Facebook contracted with Datalogix to learn whether ads on Facebook drove in-store sales. He induced Facebook to share what they would not with agencies, the names and email addresses and information about its users, so he could match these individuals with those in the Datalogix database. We could then say, these 10 million people saw this ad and spent X dollars before the ad campaign and Y dollars after the campaign. For the first time, the media impact on sales in terms of millions of people was done. Facebook told advertisers they could prove what drove sales and publicly praised Datalogix. The company, Rosa says, demonstrated that what products people purchased before was a much more valuable predictor of future purchases than clicks, page views, time spent watching or reading an ad, or search data. And not only could Datalogix demonstrate whether an ad campaign worked, Rosa says, it had the ability to create addressable ads by marshaling its data to aim ads at likely consumers. Today, Rosa is the co-senior vice president of Datalogix, and three other companies that have been grouped together in what is now called the Oracle Data Cloud. In 2016, its database contained 2 billion worldwide consumer profiles, including 110 million U.S. households. Were they a threat to agencies? No, Rosa responded. We're a technology company. We partner well with agencies. Unlike companies such as Deloitte, we don't sell services. We don't place ads or create them. On the other hand, Silicon Valley companies like Oracle are not renowned for staying in their lane. Salesforce.com has clearly veered into the agency lane. Entering 2016, Salesforce.com had acquired four companies, ExactTarget, Buddy Media, Radian6, and Brighter Option, to erect a marketing cloud. They aimed to serve as the brain for clients, assembling customer data, devising content messages to reach consumers, making these messages addressable to targeted individuals, and linking consumers directly with brands. Surveying tech companies who have jumped into cloud marketing, an April 2016 report by Pivotal analyst Brian Weiser concluded, Salesforce.com appears best positioned to compete as a brain for marketers, and it contributes to our expectation that Salesforce.com should be the fastest growing company in our coverage over extended periods of time. Public relations firms also strive to disrupt agencies. Interviewed in 2016 at the annual conference of the Public Relations and Communications Association, or PRCA, Europe's foremost PR and communications membership organization, Martin Sorrell extolled public relations as a good business that was getting better for two reasons. The first is because data has become more and more important. The other is digital. Digital has made public relations much more important than it was because of 24/7 communications at all levels. You can gain or lose a reputation at a click. Executives increasingly rely on PR crisis managers to douse fires. Few public relations firms have expanded their reach more than Edelman, a privately owned public relations company with 6,000 employees in 64 countries, and such blue-chip clients as Unilever, Johnson & Johnson, Starbucks, Adobe, Samsung, Mars, and Kellogg's. The firm is run by Richard Edelman, son of the company's late founder. From his airy open office high above bustling Hudson Street, where new buildings sprout up all around him, he says, I decided that the only way to succeed in a world where classic distribution mechanisms, newspapers and local TV news and radio opportunities, were not only shrinking but evaporating, and where social networks became the primary distributors of news, and where consumers were allergic to ads and relied on ad blockers to defend against them, was for his firm to change. 20% of Edelman's business is now digital, he says. He disagrees with Martin Sorrell that PR agencies can't supply creative content to clients. I believe earned media, pitching and telling stories, is the new paid. it's going to be very hard to get stuff through the ad blockers. One of their campaigns that did evade ad blockers was, as noted earlier, for Vaseline, a Unilever product. Unilever prides itself on being a socially conscious company, and in its marketing often sells not just its products, but the company's social mission, which Unilever also knows is a way to navigate past the skepticism of millennials. In 2014, they asked the Edelman Agency to develop a social mission for Vaseline that linked the product to healing dry skin. An Edelman team conducted research and learned that dry skin can lead to infections and serious health issues. They came across a Washington Post story of two dermatologists who visited Syrian refugee camps in Europe and the Middle East and discovered that 70% of the refugees fleeing Syria had cracked skin and blistered feet. Working with Unilever in 2015, they launched the Vaseline Healing Project, donating 1 million jars of Vaseline and recruiting dermatologists to heal skin. The Healing Project was featured in sponsored content orchestrated by Edelman Online, but also broke out as a TV and newspaper story. Referring to the tens of millions of dollars Jeb Bush spent on TV ads before he dropped out of the Republican presidential primary contest in the winter of 2016, Edelman said, "There's a reverse relationship between how much advertising you buy and how trusted you are. You're trusted if you're seen as spontaneous or authentic." Unilever passed that test. And as we would stunningly learn, so did the winner of the Republican nomination, Donald Trump. When public relations legends like Edward Bernays toiled earlier in the last century, their prime mission was to establish the public image of clients. They usually came to the table after the advertising agency shaped the advertising campaign. Today, they often sit at the table from the start. Richard Edelman explains that classic PR growth has stalled, requiring agencies like his to evolve our traditional PR business into a communications marketing agency. To advance this goal, Edelman hired 400 creatives and planners to work with clients like Samsung, Unilever, and Heineken. Edelman has entered advertising's inner kingdom, the 30-second television ad. Richard Edelman recalls that when his employees created a Kellogg's YouTube story for the Winter Olympics of a 4-year-old girl who one day became an Olympian, Kellogg's CMO told him, "We want that as an ad." Edelman's 400 creatives and planners now devise the kind of ads that were once the exclusive province of ad agencies. "We recast our business as communications marketing," he says. "The reason we did that was that we wanted access to the marketing budgets, and we wanted to signal you don't have to go to an ad agency to get marketing results." If Edelman and other PR agencies are nipping at the heels of ad agencies, Martin Sorrell and the other holding companies are not standing still. A reason giant holding companies like WPP diversified and now own some of the most prominent PR agencies, Burson Marsteller, Hill & Knowlton, Finsbury, Cohn & Wolf, was both a defensive and offensive gesture. WPP aims to offer a full range of services. Donald Baer, who oversees 2,300 employees in 110 countries for Burson Marsteller, serves such clients as Bank of America, Microsoft, Intel, and Ford. He envisions two categories of growth in public relations. One is strategic counseling, helping shape the message and reputation and projecting a positive corporate image, as well as providing crisis counseling to companies. The second is what he refers to as integrated communications. That's the injection of the digital, social, mobile, and content creation revolution that is transforming this business and is the work that advertising and marketing agencies do. That's where we have had to move. Most of our growth is in this second category. Today, he says 25 to 30% of his employees work in integrated communications. Tomorrow, 60% will. Inevitably, Baer knows he will at times be competing with his sister ad agencies at WPP. Reflecting the up-in-the-air nature of the marketing world, increasingly agency clients turn not just to public relations firms or consultancies or tech firms, but hire fresh startup agencies or turn inward. The Association of National Advertisers announced in February 2016 that brands were increasingly abandoning old-school agencies as out of touch. They were turning to startups, particularly to help them navigate social media and incorporate new technologies. As we've seen, many of the largest brands have snatched their media buying away from agencies and established in-house programmatic media buying. Prominent brands like General Electric and PepsiCo envision a day when they will spend less on advertising and become content creators, marketing and interacting with their consumers online. GE wants to be a publisher, a content creator, says Sam Olstein, who is their director of innovation, supervises GE's Disruption Lab. GE will expand their filmmaking and sponsorship of content, either brought to you by GE, or featuring GE scientists, or engaging characters and selling their content to platforms, or placing content on GE websites. Olstein says, "We hope we can build an ecosystem or platform on a par with other media platforms out there." Pepsi set up a content center and recruited creative talent to produce content they can sell. A reason Pepsi made this move, Brad Jakeman, president of the Global Beverage Group, told an audience at the 2016 Cannes Festival, is because agencies are too rooted in the past. "I've been asking the advertising industry for years to evolve their business, and they haven't. We value our agencies. But we also need the ability to produce fast. Fast may not equal effective. Few brands have been as successful as Red Bull in creating their own media platform that creates events that are covered by news organizations. It is costly, which is one impediment. And it may be delusional." Rashad Tabakawala of Publicis cautions, "Brands want to talk about their brands, which in most cases is boring as hell, and does not make an ongoing content platform." Disruption is driven by frustration with agencies and by new business opportunities innovative technologies offer. On a deeper level, disruption is driven by a new reality. Citizens are increasingly hostile to interruptive ads, as we've seen repeatedly. So advertisers experiment with native ads meant to seduce users with narratives, or ads that don't seem like ads, with new mobile ad formats, including 6-second videos, instead of 30-second ads, created by upstart companies like Cargo, with discounts and buy buttons. A popular and socially useful app aimed at reducing drunk driving fatalities was introduced by the Mindshare agency on behalf of Campari America, which makes Sky Vodka, Wild Turkey, and Campari. They created in-app messages, sent Friday evenings to sports bars, containing a $5 discount coupon with the ride-sharing Lyft. Campari enjoyed a huge jump in its brand awareness and probably saved lives. Among the more effective marketing ploys to reach younger consumers has been influencer marketing. Young influencers have their own channels or platforms on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, as well as their own websites. The route Samantha Fishbein, Aline Cooperman, and Jordana Abraham took was unusual. They are not glamorous, wear little makeup, pin their hair up quickly, and enjoy the easy rapport of three girls who grew up around the corner from each other in Roslyn, Long Island, attended the same public schools, and the same college. As bored seniors at Cornell, they started blogging and tweeting anonymously as the Betches. "We made fun of the ridiculous culture around us, without being a hater," Samantha says. After graduating in 2011 and getting jobs and returning to their parents' nests, they decided to try and popularize the Betches. As the Betches, they anonymously published a paperback book in 2013, Nice is Just a Place in France, How to Win at Basically Everything. It became a national bestseller. Success invited attention, and they promoted themselves in a New York Times interview, followed by others. Their website made fun of the lifestyle they enjoyed, including incessant partying, They posted pictures on Instagram with captions like, "The best emoji for flirting and to get you laid." Their upper-middle-class audience of 18 to 30-year-old females doesn't take themselves too seriously and likes to have a good time, Samantha says. No one would go and protest for something they believed in. It's very much about yourself, the me generation. Not feeling comfortable that they could perform as well in a video format like YouTube, their preferred platform was Instagram. Impressed with their young female audience, advertisers sold ads on their Betches platforms, providing funds for them to rent an office on East 28th Street in Manhattan. There was rarely an agency between the Betches and the advertiser when they were hired as influencers. By late 2015, they were doing 20 influencer ads per month for such clients as Smirnoff, the Bumble dating app, and Captain Morgan Rum. They assembled 15 contract writers and an overall staff of 35. They asked clients to send them the message they wanted conveyed. "Usually we put it in our own words," Samantha says. "We said that the least promotional way to sell is the best." She continued, "When we started, we didn't want people to think we are bought by advertisers." They quickly got over their qualms. "You can't sell out anymore. Everyone is doing it." "The key," says Jordana, "is doing it in a way that seems organic and natural. They don't want to know you're paid. Even if they do know, they don't want it in their face." Asked if he believed the survival of advertising agencies was threatened, just as newspapers and magazines and music companies have been, David Pemcell, the CEO of the Guardian Media Group in London, said, "I do. These agency guys are smart. However, they probably are surprised by how quickly change comes and the agility of the digital world. With the pace of change, it puts all of us under threat all the time." 13. Marketing yak-yaks and mounting fear. "We're weeks away from Armageddon." Michael Kasson. At the start of each year, the entire marketing community, buyers and sellers, agencies, clients, publishers and platforms, Hollywood studios, digital and software and hardware companies, flock to CES in Las Vegas. Once, attendees came to tour the electronic exhibits, hoping to catch a glimpse of the future and to meet and greet. Michael Kasson would come to CES with his friend Irwin Gottlieb to walk the floors of the various hotels that house the exhibitions. Then, CES expanded its reach, and Michael Kasson assumed an outsized role. In 2010, to broaden their support in the tech community, CES called on Kasson to help lure Steve Ballmer, then CEO of Microsoft, a MediaLink client, to attend MediaLink's cocktail party. Ballmer has become a regular at this event. Kasson started stumping for more advertisers to attend CES. Gary Shapiro, the president and CEO of the Consumer Technology Association, which produces CES, liked the idea, and Kasson offered a deal Shapiro welcomed. He would lobby brand advertisers and agencies to attend, and in return, CES would give MediaLink VIP status to create a reserved space in an established hotel where Kasson and brands and clients could conduct closed-door meetings, as well as a separate venue where MediaLink could host and invite speakers and moderate panels. CES would also co-sponsor with MediaLink the opening night kickoff cocktail party and would encourage a MediaLink dinner that became a must-be-invited-to meal for $350. Little wonder that after Peter Kafka of the online publication Recode followed Kasson around at CES in 2014, he lightheartedly described him as the Godfather. Kasson became the schmoozer-in-chief. His visits to CES coincided with the upheaval in the entertainment and marketing world. Members of the film and television communities started coming to CES in the late 1990s and early in this century, when new technologies like HDTV were seen as disruptors, and a debate raged as to whether the living room would be controlled by the TV or by computers. Advertisers followed, not just because Michael Kasson invited them, but because they had the same curiosity about the companies and technologies that could disrupt their business. Michael has put himself in the center of what's taking place, says Karen Chupka, CES Senior Vice President for Corporate Business Strategy. By working together as partners, she adds, I never walk away feeling, oh, I gave something to Michael. I always feel like we got something better together. January 2016 was CES's 49th anniversary, and 176,000 attendees filled 150,000 Las Vegas hotel rooms and walked the length of 50 football fields worth of exhibits. Stepping out of any hotel, neon signs beckoned visitors to come see the past perform. Donnie and Marie, Olivia Newton-John, Wayne Newton. Or one could visit the future at just about any nearby hotel to see the 20,000 products on exhibit. Keith Weed of Unilever, who Kasson says was the first client to ask him to arrange a tour of the exhibition floors, explains why he comes to CES annually. If you're going to get to the future, first, you better have an idea of the future. If I can stay ahead, it gives me an advantage. Plus, he adds, everyone is here. Like other clients, Weed told MediaLink what he was most interested in doing at CES. This year, he wanted a curated exhibition tour to explore three subjects: artificial intelligence, virtual reality, and the Internet of Things. In addition to Unilever, MediaLink had a total of 100 clients attending and would curate 582 floors and meetings with advertisers, agencies, and digital companies. A staff of 40 was in attendance, each person responsible for accompanying a group of clients: J.P. Morgan Chase, GE, McDonald's, NBC, Hearst, Gawker, The New York Times, as well as organizing public session panels for agency clients like Digitas, Publicis's digital media agency. We're like the official Sherpas for our clients, Wenda Millard says. Sporting his Christmas tan from Turks and Caicos, Kasson, casually attired in gray khakis and a wheat-colored crew neck thrown over a white shirt, met Tuesday afternoon with the MediaLink team to discuss their agenda for the rest of the week. They reviewed last-minute additions to the 4,000 people invited to a party that evening billed as a MediaLink event, even though the names in small print at the bottom of the prominent posters were those who paid for the party: Group M, Havas, Omnicom, IPG, Digitas, Variety, among others. They reviewed the 350 invites to their more exclusive Wednesday executive dinner. At this CES, unlike many industry confabs, John Mandel did not seem to excite a fever of discussion. In between hugs and high fives, Michael Kasson mostly spent the day gliding from MediaLink's CES space in the Aria Hotel, where it hosted panels. Its private Aria Sky Suites, where he met with clients and visitors, and at another hotel where he was to interview NBC Universal CEO Steve Burke on a main stage, just as he interviewed Les Moonves the year before and Twitter CEO Dick Costolo the year before that. Kasson constantly peppered staffers with questions. When he learned that PepsiCo CEO Indra Nooyi would attend their dinner, he asked, "Is this a Pepsi or a Coke hotel?" The answer did not matter. He wanted Pepsi served. He fielded a flood of email requests, including one from Martin Sorrell asking if he could bring two guests to Wednesday's dinner, and one from a CMO asking to meet tomorrow for what Kasson guessed was personal advice on seeking a new job. Anxious that his executive dinner be flawless, accompanied by his daughter, Brett Kasson-Smith, who was coordinating it, they visited the Foxtail at the SLS Hotel, a combination indoor and outdoor space that she said could accommodate no more than 350. Aware that he had said yes to Sorrell and others, she addressed her father by his first name and warned, "Michael, you have to understand, we can't squeeze more than 350 in here. People pushed too far outside will not be able to see Lady Gaga perform." and she knew rain was in the forecast, which would close off most of the outdoor space. He bobbed and weaved, never once agreeing. With Universal Music donating Lady Gaga, and with Condé Nast sharing half the $400,000 evening's cost with MediaLink, but not half the branding credit, and with sports celebrities like Alex Rodriguez attending, he was the host of the hottest event of CES. He knew, his daughter knew, his